on a lake. She is dreaming, she is drifting, never been so wide awake. Captured in the moment by the beauty all around her, there's nowhere else that she would rather be.
Hello and welcome. This is Karen Motokaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It, the place where inspiration and possibility meet on KDRT 95.7 FM. Do you ever wonder if those who teach and preach are actually living in line with what they tell you to do? I often talk about The Wizard of Oz and When Dorothy Sees Beyond the Illusion of the Wizard. Today's guest, Zach Bissonette, is here to take us behind the green door of many thought leaders, influencers, and athletes who live out of alignment with what they say. Zach has been on the show before, where he pulled the curtains open on higher education when we discussed his first book, Debt Free You. His latest book is Good Advice from Bad People, and I'm looking forward to another eye-opening conversation with Zach. Zach, hello and welcome back.
Great to be here. This is a really, really good show, so it's cool to be on again.
Well, thank you. So, you know, I want to have a little backstory. When originally your publisher sent me Debt Free You and I looked at it, and I was like, oh, you know, I've been part of higher education. I'm really good with money. Would this really lead me to any insight that I don't know? And I started reading it and I was blown away because you really pulled the curtain back. And the things that you said, I started putting together the pieces and it made a lot of sense. Right. And it was
great. Thank you. Oh my gosh. This is keep talking.
No, it was great. And that's why I still recommend this book years later to people. I'm constantly, especially as, you know, all the parents are like frantic and desperate. There's so much, like if you're on Facebook and a lot of my friends are on Facebook and they have kids that are going off to college. And, so there's so much fear and despair and there's desperation and they're willing to do just about anything. And so I was
right. And they have a lot of people trying to get them to do almost anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as your book points out, these people who you think are on your team, right, the financial aid counselors, the high school counselors, all these people, they have actually an invested interest in where you go with that brand name.
Right. There's always a problem. You know, the incentives are not aligned well.
Yeah.
You have this financial aid office, you know, but they're really there to aid the school financially, not the students, certainly not their parents. Totally.
Yeah, so it was a great book. I will have the link that I did with Zach on this interview page, but I do want to talk about your latest book, Good Advice from Bad People, because you really go, once again, go behind or go and look at the contradictions between what these people say and how they live their life.
Exactly.
And why did you do this?
You know, what got me interested in this was I would always see these people being promoted by the media as these kind of heroes, and sometimes it was self-help authors, sometimes it was political leaders, sometimes it was business leaders, and we really didn't know anything about them, and we were told how inspiring they were, but there's no real vetting process to become an inspirational icon in America. You know, ideally, there would be some sort of system, you know, where it would be like karate, where, you know, you start out as a yellow belt or whatever, and then you keep working your way up and proving it, and it would be very systematic, the way that you would sort of rise to become a thought leader and an inspirational icon. But something like that, all it really seems to take to become someone people view as a hero is, you know, some charisma, an ability to tell people what they want to hear, you know, and an ability to build some sort of platform in order to get the message out. And so, you know, time and again, we see these people who we were told were such heroes sort of unmasked as people who were, you know, saying one thing and then doing something really different.
Okay, so you make a really good point about there's no real vetting process. But don't we as Americans think that, hey, this person's got a legitimate book deal with this publishing company, so therefore, the things that they write about should be good. Or this person's been on this television platform or has, you know, written, like you talk about Jonah Lerner, was it Lerner?
Lerner, yeah.
Yeah. And he used to write for the New Yorker, right?
Right.
So we kind of think that, okay, if once they're in these platforms, isn't that the vetting?
I think often everyone else thinks someone else is doing the vetting. You know, it's sort of a weird kind of pyramid scheme like that, you know, where they, you know, it starts out with them having a blog on somewhere obscure where there isn't much vetting to get that. and then someone else sees that and thinks that that means that they have credibility, and they kind of are able to pyramid this thing up until, you know, in the case of, you know, someone, and this is a funny story, actually, so it's a tragic story, but, you know, James Arthur Ray, who was one of the gurus of The Secret, and he was on Oprah Winfrey's show. She was promoting him as this hero. And then he, you know, held a sweat lodge retreat where people were paying, you know, $10,000 to, you know, do the sweat lodge thing with Oprah guru James Arthur Ray. And two people died because he did not know what he was doing. He was a complete charlatan. And then he went to prison for a few years. And what's really interesting about him, you know, you talk about sort of old heroes dying hard. He's been out of prison for, I think, about 6 months, maybe. And he's back doing his gurudom and his motivational speaking and his tweeting and his Facebook posting, you know, with, you know, these inspirational aphorisms. And, you know, this is a guy who killed two people and was found responsible for their deaths and went to prison for it. You know, and no one had ever vetted him. And I think people assumed, you know, that because he'd been in this documentary, The Secret, and then because he'd been on Oprah, you know, that he was someone they could trust, and it turned out not to be the case. But, you know, and it's funny, is I wanted to include him in my book because he's sort of a perfect example of good advice from bad people, except that I read, you know, much to my regret, I actually read two of his books, and they were so sort of badly written and so sort of obtusely written, I literally couldn't find anything to quote. I couldn't figure out what any of it meant.
So that's how you decided to throw it out?
I had to not include them in the book as much as I wanted to.
So if we can't trust or, you know, rely on these other sources to properly vet, right, then what's the vetting process that we should be doing?
You know, I think it really comes down to trying to be less dependent on cults of personality. And I think there's kind of a human impulse in a lot of ways to kind of, you know, to kind of rely on that. I think a lot of people, you know, want those charismatic leaders. And, you know, one of the people, and I quoted him in the book, there's a guy named Marjo Gortner, who was a sort of child evangelist celebrity in the 1940s and 1950s, and, you know, he did these sermons, he sold records, and he was making, you know, I think he made a couple $1 million. And his mother, you know, starting when he was 6 years old, he would go and do these Pentecostal tent revival events. And his mother was kind of this stage mother, but instead of the movie, she was turning her kid into this evangelist. It was very, very strange. And, you know, he would say things like, hell is a place of extreme bodily suffering, and hell you'll be oh so lonely. You know, and he would do these sort of fire and brimstone sermons that would get people really excited, and they would give their money. And then in the 1970s, once he was, I think, in his late 20s and early 30s, he renounced his sort of charlatan evangelism. But before he did that, he went on a tour where he did one last tour as, you know, former boy wonder Marjo Gortner, to do a documentary to show kind of the tricks of the trade. And he was asked why he did this. And what he said was, you know, I hope that people will see it's not necessary to look to some person to kind of give you faith and, you know, and to give you something to believe in. So he said, you know, he wasn't there to trash faith or positive thinking or anything like that. He just wanted people to know that they didn't need to be so reliant on a charismatic leader in order that they could think for themselves and kind of take things from different places and try to learn things and not be so reliant on these charismatic leaders. And I think that there's a lot to that. And I think that's part of my answer is, you know, maybe we shouldn't be looking so desperately for people to lead us.
I think that's important, but we don't want to get to the point where we're so skeptical that we can't trust anybody.
Absolutely. No, right. And so, you know, you want to rely on the information that people are giving you. Does this make sense? Is this good advice? And by the way, you know, if someone is giving good advice and you find it, you know, uplifting on some level, does it really matter to you if they're, you know, unfaithful to their spouse or that kind of thing? You know, you could make an argument, no, that, you know, you're still deriving something of value from this person, you know, and the fact that they're a charlatan in a lot of ways is maybe less important to you.
Yeah. And, you know, because I think about what are the nuggets that you can get, like not following a blueprint, right? And we kind of break apart blueprints a lot on the show, that there's the 6-step process, and that's really not how it works.
Of course, no, that's a thing that people come up with because that's a good packaging concept for a book. But, you know, I mean, very few things really come in numbered lists like that.
Yeah. But so what I hear you saying is that we don't want to be on either end of the spectrum, like, oh my gosh, you're going to be a total devout follower, or you're going to be totally skeptical, not trust anybody, but really have an agile mind and check in with, does this resonate with me? Am I okay with getting this information here, even though I see that maybe they have different values when it comes to marriage or faith or something else? Am I okay with that, there being that incongruence there? Or maybe they're not even talking about marriage, but, you know, maybe we've had lots of leaders who live different lives, right, than the general family values.
No, you know, I actually just did a magazine piece that hasn't run yet on the life and death of Thomas Kincaid, who was the painter of light, who was this, you know, sort of very, very inspirational, best-selling painter in America and really a Christian family values guy. And he died, you know, of alcoholism, you know, with a mistress, and, you know, and the details of his life, it turned out, were, you know, were very tawdry. But, you know, when I was doing the piece and talking to people who sort of still collect his work, they still derive value, you know, and are able to be inspired by his work and, you know, see that, you know, yes, he wasn't perfect and he struggled with things as anyone does, but, you know, this message he gave was still, you know, very helpful to them. And so they overlook it, you know? And so it's interesting to see how people sort of can deal with this differently.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be so black and white, but realizing that, I think one of your points is, and you can tell me where I'm wrong, Zach, is that just because these people are thought leaders or influencers or even very successful athletes or business people does not mean that they are not flawed.
Right. Well, and, you know, in a lot of cases, and I want to be careful here, but it's likely often to mean that they are more flawed because, you know, when you look at when you talk to psychiatrists and psychologists, you know, a narcissistic personality disordered person is very likely to seek the spotlight. And so, you know, when you look at the sort of top professions for people, you know, who are narcissistic, you know, a lot of times it is TV personalities, politicians, journalists in some cases, you know, motivational speakers, pastors. You know, these people often are. You know, not that they're worse than other people on average, but that they tend to deal with certain issues that are much more prevalent among that set.
Well, so, you know, my husband, one of his first, he's had a couple Olympians, and his first Olympian from years ago, one of the things that she said is that if, you know, parents who want their kids to be well balanced, it's the end road is not to be an Olympic athlete. You know, and she says with different language, but for language for the radio show, that they are the most messed up people on the planet, right? If you look at the bell curve, they're on the other end of the spectrum because of the sacrifices, because of the things that they're willing to do that really aren't normal, right?
Right. You know, it's an interesting, and then they're lionized as these kind of inspirational figures with crossover in a way that I'm not sure. I mean, there was a big trend in the 90s especially, and still going today, of, you know, companies bringing in Olympic athletes, you know, to be speakers, you know, to their employees to kind of rah-rah and rally them and motivate them and kind of teach them about success and that kind of thing. And, you know, and I'm not the first person to point this out, but, you know, that in most cases, if you really look at the lives of Olympians, you know, that sort of singular focus and drive, and kind of tunnel vision is something that would get you fired from most companies. Mm-hmm. You know, and so yes, it was hugely helpful for becoming an Olympic athlete, but does it really have the crossover to have to succeed in other areas of life? It's not clear to me that it does. Mm-hmm. I mean, and your husband would know this better because he's worked with these people.
Well, I think it goes back to, you know, when parents are striving and they watch the Olympics, and it's understanding, and you understand this, like, just in the book publishing, right? There is the illusion that NBC puts out there, and then there's the reality of what goes on behind the scenes, right?
Exactly. Yeah, of course.
To get there. And, you know, I was in London for 2012, and I remember after all the hoopla of having to get there and get tickets and everything, and finally climbing up, sitting in my seat, sitting down, and after 30 minutes going, this is just another swim meet. Right. I mean, it's pretty exciting to be there, but it's another swim meet. Right. And in some ways, there's people there that are really slow compared to like the United States Olympic trials, because it is the Olympics, and they want to bring in countries like from Africa.
Right.
Right.
And
that's a great thing. But then you start to realize, wow, this is another swim meet, but it's been hyped because of the media. And think about how much the media and corporate sponsorships have really changed the Olympics over the decades.
Right. And, you know, and have turned people into, you know, sort of larger stars when really what they are is more narrow in mm-hmm. a lot of cases.
They are narrow. So, well, one of the things that I want to go back to is when you wrote your book, and it came to me. I'm kind of a skeptic by nature. And so it came to me, and I'm like, oh, he's this young guy. I think you were still in college when we did the interview. And I'm like, oh, he's got to be this rich person's or influential person's son. That's how he got a book deal with a good publisher.
I think you overestimate how hard it is to get a book deal.
But I've also had kids of influential parents on my show, right? And I know how hard it, but, you know, but that was kind of my first initial kickback. And then I'm reading your story. And so that's one of the things when I promote your book to people, I will talk about, no, this guy's really legitimate. You know, he had to put himself through college. He's the one that figured this out, right? You created this path for yourself. You're self-made. It's not because, you know, you had folks in the industry who maybe had connections that could at least get you a jump start, right?
Right. Yeah.
But so, you know, when I first even came to you, I was a bit skeptical. Are you naturally skeptical by nature?
Yeah, no, I mean, extremely. I mean, I was, you know, sort of looking into the college process, you know, hearing all this stuff people tell you, you know, and then thinking about, well, wait a minute, is that really true? What's their angle on this? Why are they telling me this? And you start to realize that, you know, especially in college, it's a perfect example of that, you know, the advice you're getting from a lot of people, you know, it often has nothing to do with your best interest.
Mm-hmm. And then with this book, why the focus further on these thought leaders why the focus? Because it seems like there's kind of the same theme of let's go behind the curtain, as I've said many times.
Right. Well, what interested me with this was, you know, just kind of thinking about sort of behavioral change and how to, you know, is, you know, that, you know, this thing we always talk about in personal finance, that this stuff's all behavioral, and it, you know, and it's not really about knowing stuff. You need to know a certain amount, but in most cases, you know, it's really, really about behavior, and that, you know, these people were able to, you know, write these books and very elegantly, you know, convey these messages, and then, you know, they would just completely, you know, fail to live up to them. And, you know, one of the ones that, you know, that I had in the book that I, you know, was Thomas Weeks, who's a pastor, who was a marriage expert and had a show on TBN, and his marriage was broadcast live on international television. He did a book called Teach Me How to Love You, The Beginnings. It was about how to build a relationship. And he said, you know, it's not fair to marry a woman and not be concerned with fulfilling her dreams. And so I thought, okay, that's a nice line, you know, that, you know, it's really, you know, that when you're in a partnership with someone, you really should be, you know, interested in how do you kind of make their dreams come true. That's a nice sentiment. And then, you know, a few years after that book came out, he was arrested for, you know, viciously beating his wife at the time in a hotel parking lot. And he explained that he had been violent toward her because she was so ambitious, you know, and would stop at nothing to try to achieve her dreams. And rather than help, his response was domestic violence. You know, and so, you know, just kind of these stories about these people who were these thought leaders on these topics, you know, and then just, you know, would fail in, you know, dramatic, tragic, sometimes funny in a way, sometimes tragicomic, to live up to their own advice.
So when you're doing your writing, and this is your third book, and you also write for lots of media outlets, but when you do your writing, do you reflect on, hey, am I living within what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, I mean, for me, it was, I think, you know, for me, it's sort of an accountability partner, is the fact that, you know, that I'm doing this book. So I feel like I have to kind of live up to it, and especially now that I've done this book. I mean, if I did a book called Good Advice from Bad People, and then I didn't follow the advice from my personal finance book, it'd be sort of ironic on so many levels that I don't think I could live if I did that.
But people do that. Like, I always think about when I work with people, like in finances, if I'm going to hire you in my life, I need to know that you're actually doing that with your own bit, you know, your own personal stuff. Right.
Right. Right. No, absolutely.
One of the things I wonder about you, Zach, is integrity an important value for you?
Totally. Of course. Yeah. Very much so.
And so is that like kind of your guidepost as you go about and do the work that you do in your life?
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, and in this book, you know, totally was spotting people where that guidepost was maybe not there to the extent that it should have been.
And when we live out of alignment, when this kind of dichotomy happens,
right,
what, and then these people are able to come back, like you just talked about, who was it, the one with the sweat house, and he's been to prison and he's come back and he's starting. Why as public are we going back to these people, or are they bringing in new people?
Yeah, no, I think in the case of James Arthur Ray, the sweat lodge guy, from my sort of digging into it, it seems to be that it was his old fans who kind of view him as this sort of almost martyr for some reason. And I think the ones who come back, it often speaks to their sociopathy. I mean, the ones who sort of mess up and then go into, you know, then go and move on with their lives and try to do something else, those are the ones who think, okay, maybe, you know, maybe they really did legitimately make a mistake that they feel terrible about, you know, and are trying to move on, and they're not bad people, they just messed up. But, you know, when a motivational speaker kills two of his customers, and, you know, and then is going back at it the second he's out of prison, you wonder about that.
Mm-hmm. And you brought up a really good point, because kind of in America, right, we love the fact that we can start over, you can reinvent yourself. I mean, shoot, there's a huge market just for women in their 40s and 50s of just reinvent yourself, right? So where does the line draw between, you know, going back, like being really destructive, and then starting over, and kind of this idea that, hey, we live in the society where you can reinvent yourself?
Yeah, generally speaking, I would say that if you've killed your customers, it's time to find a new line of work. I mean, you know, in the case of James Arthur Ray, you know, but in other cases, I mean, there's one guy I wrote about in the book, you know, who some of your listeners might remember, which was Ted Haggard, who was a, you know, a pastor of a mega church and head of the National Association of Evangelicals. You know, in a very, you know, is big within that world, you know, as you can be. And he was, you know, on television a lot, and he wrote a book called From This Day Forward, Making Your Vows Last a Lifetime. And he said, God will bless your marriage to the degree to which you are obedient to his covenantal design. If you disobey the terms of the covenant, your marriage will fail. If you ignore the structures of your marriage relationship, you are vulnerable to disaster. And then, you know, a couple years, I mean, it was not more than a couple years after that happened, he was caught with a gay prostitute in crystal meth. He lost his church. He lost his whole platform. He lost his whole thing. You know, and then he sort of went underground for a few years. And then he's come back with a new church. He's still with his wife. He still apparently loves her. And, you know, and he has started a new church where he's kind of changed his message. And he said, you know, I was too judgmental with my previous approach, and this is really, he calls it the gospel of giving people a break, you know, and that his new kind of church is really about, you know, that we're all flawed, and, you know, and trying to kind of show people, you know, look, I did this horrible thing, and I, you know, came through it, you know. So him, I actually have a lot of respect for, because he seems to have learned from, you know, learned from and changed himself based on his previous sort of fall.
You know, thank you for sharing that you have respect for him, because
I do. No, I totally, you know, it was funny. I told him, you know, I had talked to him a little bit, and I told him that I was putting him in the book, you know, but that I didn't really see it as a mean thing, you know, even when putting him in a book called Good Advice from Bad People, you know, that, you know, when you read the write-up on him, it's kind of manifest that I don't really consider him a bad person at all, but he does fit into this kind of say one thing, do something different mode, you know, but that I see him as someone who was really, you know, has a lot to give people and has tried to do that. And, you know, and that was kind of the most interesting thing to me in this book, was teasing out, you know, how many of these people, you know, are just kind of, you know, flew too close to the sun on wings of wax and, you know, and fell and, you know, and are not bad people, you know, versus how many of them are true sociopaths. And Ted Haggard is certainly, I would say, in the, you know, good person who messed up and learned from the category. I think it's actually more interesting to me that these are not all sort of complete degenerates. A lot of these are people who tried.
Well, that's...
And I think in a lot of cases had these very high values, you know, that they struggled to live up to and ultimately failed, but, you know, but the goals were sincere.
Well, one of the things you say in your book is that, you know, listen carefully, because usually the people that are talking about it so passionately, it's because they're personally struggling it with it within their own life.
Right. Because in a lot of cases, you know, there was one, you know, one self-help expert in here who, you know, had written about the importance of not using violence to solve your problems. And I think most people kind of know that. And, you know, that when you're sort of lecturing so sanctimoniously about the importance of not resorting to violence, you know, you kind of have to wonder whether that's indicative of some internal conflict. And then a couple years after that book came out, the guy was, you know, arrested for hiring a hitman to kill his wife's ex-husband's stepfather. And then he'd also tried to hire a hitman to kill his stepdaughter's high school principal. And the guy was someone who certainly did resort to violence. I know totally. I mean, there's, you know, this thing, you know, Freud wrote about, you know, projection, you know, where you have this awful thing that you see in yourself that you sort of recoil from. So you start sort of seeing it in other people a little bit too much. And, you know, and there's certainly a lot of projection among these self-help experts.
You know, and I wonder, so I'm not sure if you're familiar with Brené Brown, but she's been a guest a bunch of times on the show. And, She's a thought leader and influencer, and she does research at University of Houston. But she, and I don't know how much of it is her being the catalyst and how much of it's because of, you know, the, where my mindset is and opening, you know, finding people like this. But one of the things that I've seen a nuance, like in the self-help world, is people like her, where they say, look, I know this stuff, but I still struggle to implement it. Or
yeah, it's always interesting the ones who admit that. And what was interesting, the ones who sort of had their falls tended to be people who did not admit that.
Ooh.
the ones who were sort of the most sanctimonious about their own moral righteousness seemed to be the ones who were the most likely to fall. The ones who would kind of say, you know, this is what I believe and I struggle with it too, weirdly seem to be better at keeping themselves sort of on the wagon.
That is really interesting. So
it's really weird. Yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like the people that you kind of put together in the book, when I was reading the book, it was like they would come out very harshly and almost in a way like there was a sense of, I'm going to shame you because I want you to follow this path.
Yeah. Yep. And, totally. No, a little bit, sometimes, you know, a little bit of a protesting too much thing.
yeah. And then they would, and then all of a sudden, you know, they would explode, right? And everything would come crashing down on them. And we could look at them and say, wait a second, here's this big contradiction, right?
Well, right. And then they often, in a weird way, sort of end up being the best evidence for their own advice, because you're seeing, you know, the sort of horrific collapse of a life when you don't follow the advice that they were giving. I mean, and the fact that the kind of the wonderful advice and the kind of, you know, the cautionary tale is contained in one person. It's sort of interesting how often that happens.
Interesting. So, because the other thing you say in your book, I'm going to read it if that's okay. Everyone praises him, but no one really knows anything about him.
Right. And this is really typical with these, you know, cults of personality, is how much do we know about what this person really, you know, has done and where they're from? And, you know, other than these sort of press clippings and what they tell us, you know, do we really have a lot of insight into this person? And often the answer is no, that the media tends to be lazy in vetting these people. And then they just kind of rise until they don't. But
so, you know, one of the things like the bloggers, you know, we'll talk about is the democratization of blogging and social media. Do you think that where we are now in 2014 is going to help shift these like kind of cult-like, because their images, right? Because some of these people you talk about are from the 70s and 80s where they could really protect their image. I mean, it's a lot harder now, isn't it?
It is a lot harder. I think it's, you know, in a weird way, the fact that there are, you know, fewer barriers to entry into becoming that, I think actually in a way helps the better people rise, because, you know, the ones who really have stuff that people value, you know, as opposed to the people who are sort of best at booking the media stuff and kind of know how to kind of manipulate the producers and, you know, and kind of get themselves out front and talk their way into publishing deals. You know, that's less important than it used to be.
So let's talk a little bit about what you said. So with manipulate the media and, you know, talk themselves into publishing deals, what do you mean?
You know, that it used to be, you know, if you look at, you know, most of the, many of these self-help experts from the 70s and 80s that I wrote about in here, you know, these were really people who, through the power of PR, were able to kind of inflict themselves on the public and, you know, by getting these media bookings, partly because they were charismatic and good on television, often physically attractive, and they were able to kind of just get themselves on television. I think, you know, I think one of the things in a good way that the internet thing, you know, and the Web 2.0 stuff has done, you know, has made it so that stuff's a little bit less important. It's really about the quality of the content, and, you know, and if you post it and if it's good, it tends to, you know, get shared, and if it's not, it doesn't. So the kind of the tricks and the wheeler dealer stuff, I think, are less central to it.
Okay. And then what about, you'd said earlier, you know, like Oprah's name's come up quite a bit because she's given stamps of approval to people, or, you know.
And I don't want to hit on Oprah too hard, partly because, you know, she's someone who has endorsed a lot of people and built a lot of careers. Some of them good, some of them not. You know, it's not like she's, it's not like she's exclusively, you know, very, very few of the self-help experts she's endorsed have killed people. One of them did, and that's tragic. But, you know, I'm not here to trash on Oprah.
Okay. So as far as well, and the other side is, I mean, because I talk about this like with Dr. Oz, right? When he was on once a week on Oprah, that he had less content he had to put out there. But when you have a 5-day a week television show.
Yeah, and he's kind of gone off the rails a little bit, scientifically at least.
Yeah, so you need to fill up airtime.
That's another, it's an interesting point that, you know, the bigger that these people get, you know, the thing you know, these people, you know, the more you're on television, the less time you have to actually know anything. you know, in the finance world, the perfect example of that is Jim Cramer at CNBC, who was a very, very smart guy. At one time, a you know, successful hedge fund manager, blah, blah, blah. And now he's on TV so much that he's, you know, incredibly dependent on, you know, production assistants and researchers. And, you know, I think, and I have no problem saying this, you know, the quality of his work has gone into the toilet. And that certainly is, you know, something that happens with these experts, that, you know, it's just overexposure. And, you know, and as you're on too much, I mean, you know, there's only so many hours a day. And if you're sleeping 8 hours a day and on television 7 hours a day and eating and playing with your kids, you know, that's not a lot of time to actually research anything.
Mm-hmm. So that is that something that you keep in thought as you craft your career?
Well, no one's asking me to be on television as much as they're asking Jim Cramer to be on television. So I'm saved from myself in that way. But no, seriously, I mean, it totally is, you know, you know, that how do you kind of keep the content central and not become so obsessed with sort of exposure that you're, because I mean, it absolutely is a seesaw that, you know, you just can't do it all. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other side is that when you have a TV show or you have, you know, the bigger you are, there's other things that you're, you know, having to worry about and being concerned about as well, right? There's a staff.
Well, you know, a lot of these guys, they want to take some of the time to spend the money, right?
Yeah. Well, but also just running it. I mean, you know, and then the pressures to be of who's putting pressure and saying, this is what you need to do. And the loss, there's really a loss of autonomy at that level. You know, as you talk about this, and when I was reading your book, I kept thinking about, you know, the movie The Lorax and the idea of too big to fail. did these people have that kind of ego of, it's just too big to fail?
Yeah, I mean, totally. And on the corporate side, because one of the things, I mean, I talk in the book a lot about sort of CEOs who fall. And, you know, overwhelmingly, and there's research to back this up, that when CEOs build their dream homes, mm-hmm. build new corporate headquarters, that oftentimes comes right before the fall of the company and certainly the fall of the CEO. And that, you know, when the hubris sets in and when the CEO starts writing self-help books and starts going on TV a lot and starts really trying to impart his wisdom to other people, that's often a sign of bad things to come. I mean, you know, one of the places people have asked, where did you find these quotes? And in a lot of cases, I found them in commencement speeches that they gave at colleges. And the frequency with which a CEO returning to his alma mater to lecture students about how to be successful, that so often comes right before their fall. I'm sort of joking, but, you know, if you own stock in a company and you see the CEO going back to his college to talk, it might be time to sell.
That's a little personal finance tip there.
We do it all here. You know.
So they do have this. Is it because they don't have people around them that can say, hey, look, I think you're out of whack? Or,
And I think part of it's that, part of the success is absolutely luck. Anyone who says it isn't is lying. And that when a CEO starts to think that he really has this, running a business thing down to a formula and a science that he should write about and share with other people, it may suggest some hubris and sort of a lack of respect for the kind of confluence of things that got them to where they are, and overconfidence in their own ability to make decisions. One of the people I wrote about in the book was Ron Johnson, who in a speech at Stanford, another one who went back to his alma mater to talk, he said, when you let your imagination win, there's no limit to what you can accomplish. And he said that right after he'd taken over as CEO of JCPenney after a very successful run as running retail operations for Apple. And one of the mistakes he made at JCPenney actually was that he relied way too much on his sort of grand vision and did very little focus group testing, very little sort of small rollout, and tried to make these big, dramatic, sweeping changes to the company. And they failed dramatically. The company lost hundreds of millions of dollars, sort of teetered to the brink of bankruptcy, and he was fired after less than 2 years on the job and, and the destruction of hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in shareholder value, in large part because, he had been telling people, when you let your imagination win, but was that really what happened at Apple for him, or was it sort of a confluence of factors, like partly the fact that Apple had a very hot product at the time that was easy to sell? I think Ron Johnson, sort of predicted his own demise in that advice, because he really felt that, he'd accomplished all the things he'd accomplished because he'd let his imagination win. And that had not been the case if you sort of go back and look at the case study of Apple, but he thought it was and proceeded to really get in over his head with it at JCPenney.
And so, are these people saying, I know what I know and I'm not going to reflect or do something different?
I think there's a lot of that, that the best CEOs, two CEOs who've never written self-help books are Steve Jobs and Warren Buffett. And kind of interesting, because I think most people would put those probably one and two on the best of all time. And you could argue about who would be which. They certainly have different skill sets. But, a lot of the CEOs who did write books, were sort of far less powerful and less accomplished than those two. And their books so often come at the peak of their careers.
Interesting.
And I think it does suggest that they've stopped learning.
Interesting. So I want
to... Partly because, they have a job, which is to run a company. It's like, people say, well, you write books. It's like, right, I write books because that's what I do. If I were chief operating officer of Facebook, I would probably think that was enough work for right now. I wouldn't necessarily think, I better go do TED Talks and write a book.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It makes me nervous because it's a little bit, it's a certain kind of arrogance that they think, it's sort of like saying, I got this, you know, time to focus on other things.
Well, interesting. And I think that's a good thing for people to think about, right? As they're going and looking at these people, listening to your critical awareness of, hey, when people have done this, there's been a pattern of things not going well, or maybe they've lost focus within the company that they're supposed to be running, or, you know, be on that leadership team, the management team.
Right. So, yeah, totally.
So I want to go kind of to a more positive note, is that because you have said this, and I want to catch this because I don't want people to walk away and go, oh my gosh, I just need to be totally skeptical. Corinne and Zach are totally skeptical. I need to be totally skeptical. But how do we distinguish the good people from the bad people?
I think part of it is really trying to look for sort of independent evidence of what they've done and how they've lived their lives, and not being too reliant on just things that people tell you about themselves. You know, I mean, with a lot of these guys, you know, James Arthur Ray, the Oprah guy, you know, it's like, well, he's a wonderful person. He told me so himself. And it's like, well, wait a second. You know, it's like when there was so little actually known about this guy. I mean, one of the things that came out in court, you know, was that he claimed to have all this education and training, none of which he had. And if people had just done a little bit of vetting, you know, go on Google, you know, try to find out more about him. Find out whether this stuff is true. And that's part of it. And then the other thing, the big thing is, you know, kind of like Marjo Gortner, the former child evangelist, said, you know, don't try not to be so reliant on these personality-driven things. You know, find things that you think make sense and that are helpful and use those. And don't become such a fan. Don't be a follower, I think would be my main advice. And people should follow me in that.
Well, because don't you think when they become like that fan person, they just lose all their perceptual blindness, or they get perceptual
blindness? Absolutely. No. And they start to just believe everything the person says instead of sort of evaluating each thing independently, which is hard to do, but I think it's important.
So can you give an example of how you evaluate things independently?
I just try to, when you hear someone say something or read something, you know, think about it independently. Don't just say, oh, this person said it, therefore this is true or important or useful. Mm-hmm. You know, cross-reference it with other things you read. You know, don't become too reliant on one source. I mean, that was, with a lot of these people who've sort of been led down into bad things, you know, like with James Arthur Ray, it was that, you know, it becomes sort of this cult mentality where James Arthur Ray was their only source of information on things. You know, and he was saying, you know, this sweat lodge is safe. It's really, really hot. You know, when if you'd gone on Google and looked up how to do a sweat lodge, you would know that this guy didn't know what he was doing.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think what you said, something that's really important, it's like cross-reference it and don't, you know, read lots of different things, follow different people. And then one of the things that I do, and I don't know if you do this, is that I really know what my values are and, you know, kind of have my foundational principles, like my own personal guiding principles. And then I listen and I check in, and whether it's even like just say nutrition, like food, right? I think about, okay, does this live in line with our family's principles, whether it's money,
exactly.
You know, lifestyle. And I check in.
Yeah, and you pulled your family principles, you know, together from just, mm-hmm. you know, disparate things that worked for you. You know, you probably did not say, you know, see Tony Robbins on television and say, okay, Tony Robbins has nice teeth. From now on, whatever he says is what my family believes, right?
Yes. Okay. So that's one of the key, is knowing who you are and what's important to you as
right.
you go through and look for maybe
Absolutely.
The nuggets of information.
Yep.
Who are, as we wrap up, who are some people, good people that you like to follow?
You know, people who are not, you know, of course, not right about everything on finance. I think Dave Ramsey is, you know, the best of the ones that are out there right now. Even though there are things, you know, he and I disagree on mutual fund stuff, but mm-hmm. and, you know, he'd have talked about that. But, you know, so it's not that he's, you know, I think he's smart. I think his heart's in the right place. You know, a lot of the stuff he says is very good, very helpful. And it's not all true on finance, which is really, you know, really the thing I'm, I'm sort of the most qualified to talk on, I guess, it would be Dave Ramsey.
You know, and that's a good point, because as I thought about it, when we think about our friends or even our loved ones or our partners, right, there's going to be stuff that really resonates, and then there's going to be things that we may not really particularly like what they do, right? I mean, I don't like the way my husband's closet looks, but that's the way his closet is, and I can deal with that, you know? But his values, the things that are really important to me, we line up with. And that's what it sounds like you're talking about when you look at influencers or people that, you know, you may be taking advice from.
Right.
You know, what are the things that are really important to you? And don't cross your own values. Don't let your own values go out the door.
Absolutely.
Well, Zach, thank you so much for being a guest today. It's been fun talking with you again.
Fun.
All right. So that was Zach Bissonette. He's been on my show before. He has an outstanding book about debt-free university. The book is The Real Deal. And then his latest book is Good Advice from Bad People. So as I think about the show today and, you know, the good advice from bad people, and one of the things he does say in the interview is that, you know, there are people in there that he does respect or that, you know, he doesn't think are all that bad. And he mentions that in the interview that we talk about. One of the things I think he wants for you, and I definitely want for you, is for you to not rely on other people as having the sole answer to your problem, right? These thought leaders and influencers, while they can provide nuggets of information for you, it's really about you checking in and saying, does this resonate with me? Is this true? Instead of just blindly following somebody because they've had somebody else's stamp of approval, or because, you know, you're constantly seeing them in the media. Because if you think about it, isn't that kind of what advertising and PR does? Is it puts that brand out in front of you constantly so that you just become so familiar with it, you go, yes, this is what I need to do, right? And the same thing with people. So, you know, really when I think about this interview and wrapping it up is that, you know, I really invite you to be cautious when people try to shame you. And that's one of the links that, you know, reading his book and talking to Zach is that I saw of the people who were the good, had the good advice, but where he calls them the so-called quote bad people. The messages in the book were really shaming one. If you do this, you're going to go to hell. If you do this, it's a horrible sin. If you do this, the karma is going to come back to you, right? Lots of shame, and shame loves secrecy. And then what would happen is there those people's worlds would explode. Right. And everything would come collapsing down. And we as the public, if we knew about it, we'd get irate because they were not congruent with what they were telling us, what they were preaching or teaching or writing about. And that gets a lot of us frustrated. And especially Zach, obviously, because he keeps writing about these kinds of things. So really pay attention to people that try to shame you or control you or think that they know what's best for you. You know, I really believe it comes down to you knowing what's best for you. We all have our blind spots, right? We may not have answers right away, but really checking in. You know, my own process for vetting is that, you know, I check in with what are my values? You know, what are my guiding principles? You know, where is the source coming from? You know, one of the things is that, and I tend to, you know, if I'm just buying something on Amazon, I'll read their reviews. And yes, there are people that can go in and have, you know, PR reviews put in there, but I take that into consideration. I take small calculated risk of trying something out, right? I also like to have referrals from friends that are in line with my values, that I really trust and respect their opinions. And I listen to them, right? And that's it. And I go and test it out. I try to be in this compassionate observer mindset so that I'm not perceptually blind, right? Where I can go and observe, and it's not about right or wrong, and it's not about me getting into my ego, but really try to be in that place of compassion so that I can use my entire brain to figure out and be reflective afterwards. Was this, what was my intention? Did I get, you know, what I was trying to accomplish done, you know, and how can I tweak it if I want to get it better? Right. And the other thing is, and you guys hear me talk about this all the time, it's this idea of blueprints, right? And Zach said it. He goes, that's the way we sell books, right? Or the seven steps to this, or the seven steps to permanent, right? And I think everything is a practice. But, you know, it's really about, I think, what I've been able to figure out for my own life is getting nuggets of information, right? Getting nuggets of information and then testing it out. There may be people that Zach really respects that I don't. And I'm not saying that we haven't really gone through our list together, right? But, you know, and he talked about Dame Ramsey. Dame Ramsey, somebody that I've heard about for a number of years, and I may be going willing to go take a look at his stuff, right? Because Zach's background is in personal finance, and just take a look at some of Dave Ramsey's stuff. Because I do respect Zach, and then I will decide, does this work resonate with me, right? So nuggets of information from people that, you know, from a source that you trust, and then continue to make tweaks and shifts, right? And it continuously asking yourself again and again, like, does this resonate with me, right? And reading things that you may disagree with, right? Because I think that's part's important too. And he talked about cross-referencing, if you caught that part in the interview, and cross-referencing and listening to, you know, what are all the different things out there, right? And not being a fan. And I think that is so important. One of the things that the feedback I get from listeners of the show is that while I really respect the people that come on here, and there have been times that I get really excited about something that they do, or, you know, but I'm not a fan. Like, I ask the questions, I really think about it, you know, and I don't have that perceptual blindness. So, you know, not becoming a fan, you can respect their work, you can love their work. I mean, there's people's work that I really, really love, and it really resonates with me. But at the same time, is that I want to be me, you know. And I think about, like, one of the things that Oprah says is that when she first was starting out in the business, she wanted to be like Barbara Walters. And then she realized, look, Barbara Walters has got this down. I can never be her. I need to be me. And the more and more in line that we can be with ourselves, we can look at other people. It's like what I say at the show. It's right. If this is possible for them, what is possible for you? What are things that strengths maybe somebody has that you can emulate for yourself? But it's not about going on and masquerading as them. So, you know, think about this. I invite you to think about it. Send me an email what you think, right? We're in the other side is sometimes we do have blind faith, right? And we realize we walked down this path and, oh my gosh, what was I thinking? And again, shame may creep up, but remember, shame loves secrecy. You don't need to hide that part. Just own that part of your story. And instead of beating yourself up, because we know that that is not at all effective, right? Instead, I invite you to really focus on being reflective and going, okay, I had blind faith. I followed this person, whether it was a loved one, a family member, a boss, you know, a thought influencer, an athlete, somebody that you just really admire, and you took everything that they said, you know, for pure trust, through pure trust. And maybe you went down the wrong path. Okay. What can you learn from that? Right? What can you learn from that? What awareness can you take away from that so that you can tweak and move on? We do live in this great country, or, well, I know I have worldwide listeners. So those of us who live in the United States, we're really fortunate because this is a country of opportunities, right? Where people can fall down, they can get up, or you can be like Zach and myself, who we are self-made people, right? But one of the things that he said, and I think that my understanding after interviewing him, the important thing for him was when somebody was so hard on one side and then they crumbled, was really to own it and be honest about their story, right? And Brené Brown talks about that, owning our story. And when we own our story, shame, we can't stand that shame storm anymore. So that becomes really important. So I really want you to think about right now, what are your values? What are your guiding principles? You know, what is really important to you? And then once you have that down and you know who you are, right? Those are hard, big questions. They're really hard, big questions. I understand that. And you don't have to have it all figured out, but you may know one thing that's really important. Maybe it's your family. Maybe it's that you want to do great work. You know, maybe it's your friends. Maybe it's honesty. Whatever it is, find that one thing and you can continue to add to the list. It doesn't have to be all perfectly finished, right? Just start the list. It's like, I think of my grocery shopping list, right? Sometimes I'll remember, okay, I need to write this down because I'll forget. We're out of this. And I just start with the one item. Maybe it's milk and I need to write that down. And then as the day goes on or the week goes on, I keep adding to that list as things come up. And that's what you can do with this, with your values, who you are, what's important to you, right? And then as you live your life, reflect on that. Am I, you know, integrity is a really important part value for Zach. it's really important to me, right? So you can go in and check in. I mean, a lot of time when I'm doing leadership work, I'm checking in. Am I being aligned with the values that are important to me? Am I being in line with the agenda that was put forth, right? So you constantly go back and check in. It's just about conscious awareness. So think about that. That's the first thing. And then next is, where do you like to get your sources from, right? I started to realize that I'm not a good person, like especially for services around my town, just to walk in the door or just to get an ad. I'm too much of a skeptic. So I like to find out from people's experiences, right? Hence the reason I have this radio show. I like to talk with people. I like to get their insight and who are the people that I trust, right? So I take that into consideration. And then I take a small calculable risk, right? And go and do something without, you know, this whole blind faith thing. So I invite you to think about these things for yourself and remembering that, you know, what Zach wants is for us to never think that we don't have to do the vetting ourselves, right? That we can let some media outlet or some publishing company or somebody else do the vetting. It's still always important to for us to go in and check in. Maybe there are the gatekeepers, but to us go in and check in, what resonates with you? You know, what is your experience? And this can be from anything. It can be from thought leaders. It can be from retail experiences, anything that you come into contact with in your life. So that's all that I have for today. Thanks for listening to the show. My guest today was Zach Bissonette, and his book is Good Advice from Bad People. And thank you so much for the emails that you send me. I read every single one. Unfortunately, there's too many for me to respond to, but it really helps me because this show is definitely a labor of love that I do for you. I love bringing this information out for you so that you can take this information, take the nuggets, and apply certain concepts, or even just surround yourself around information about what is possible, right? It's kind of a great neighborhood to hang out in. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to How She Really Does It. I invite you to subscribe to my weekly newsletter at howshereallydoesit.com. I do this show each week for you, so you can now see the windows of possibilities in your own life. I believe there are many journeys for us to take. We can learn from others to see what is possible for ourselves. I believe there are possibilities for all of us, not just the ones who've acquired great success, but including those of us who have stumbled, lost our way, or only saw closed doors. With this show, maybe you can now see a glimmer coming through the windows. I call that the windows of possibility. Each week, I bring a guest who represents those possibilities. They too have had their own struggles and uncertainty, yet somehow they have found their way. My guests are an example of what is possible when you continue, when you learn, leap, fall down, and get back up. I invite you into this space so you can ask yourself, if that is possible for them, what is possible for me? Really ask yourself that. I would love to connect with you. Please join me at www.howshereallydoesit.com. And thanks for listening today.
On a lake, she is dreaming, she is drifting, never been so wild.